Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight on budget night of all nights to hear something that's not on the budget. So we've got Heidi Douglas making an inaugural appearance at the Sydney Institute. She's the author of Catch Up with the Sun, which has just been released by Finch Publishing. And I'll introduce her very briefly, and she's going to talk on the topic of Australia dreaming, how I rode through Australia with a short fat horse, two grumpy camels and one feral kelpie. Our speaker, Heidi Douglas, is a veterinary surgeon and a veterinary chiropractic and acupuncture practitioner. She's also a commercial pilot and was a pilot with the RAAF. She's lived and travelled all over Australia, working on a wide range of agricultural properties. Heidi Douglas currently operates her own business, practicing veterinary chiropractic services around the Rockhampton region in Queensland, and tonight to talk on Australia Dreaming. Heidi, you're very welcome. Thank you.
My name's Heidi Douglas. Thank you for coming. I rode a horse around Australia, raising money for charity for Youth Off the Streets, and I basically got the desire to do it from boarding school, from living in the city and desperate to see Australia. So I rode around Australia on a horse with pack camels and pack horses, and it's still not going.
Just give it to me.
Okay. It's set to go for 30 minutes, so I do apologise.
Do you want to go further?
Yeah, just every few seconds, just click them over. Thank you. Sorry. Doing this, I was doing it all on my own, didn't have a support crew or anything like that, didn't have any friends that wanted to help me. I had to be really prepared, and I had to be able to carry everything that I wanted with me. So I had to get some pack horses, work out, teach myself all about packing, which is actually a skill in itself, and get some pack saddles and some horses and train them. So you can see there's some photos of a friend of mine helping me training the horses. That took a fair bit. I ended up with people giving me about a total of 20 horses, and I just had to work out which ones would be helpful and which ones wouldn't be helpful and which ones could cut the grade. And I also had to make my own saddles too. Being a veterinary chiropractor, I'm pretty fussy on saddle fit. A lot of people don't care, but it really can make or break a horse. And a horse that's going to be working for me all day, every day, for months and months and even years, you really want a saddle that fits nicely. So there's a photo back there of me making the pack saddles. Yeah, that's it. And the other thing I had to do was plan a route. I had to make sure that I got water every day at least for the horses. There's no point carrying water for horses because they basically can drink the same amount that they carry. They carry 70 kilos in a day and they'll drink 70 kilos in a day, so it makes it pointless carrying water generally. So that was my preparation, which took a lot longer than that, I can assure you. And so I set off in Victoria down in Healesville near Melbourne. Let's see that red line. And so for the next 3 weeks, this is the big leaving, lots of photos and lots of people and family and everything. They were my two main horses that I had, and I set off with a couple of friends initially just for a week and then kept on going for the next couple of weeks. I was on a really steep learning curve because I'd never really done packing, and you can go packing for a weekend and come home with very sore horses and skinny horses and angry horses and throw them in the paddock for the next 3 months. But when I was doing it my way, you couldn't afford to make them sore or make them skinny. At each camp, I needed water and I needed food. That's up in the Victorian Alps. It took me 3 weeks to reach there, and by the time I got there, one of my horses was three-legged lame, which meant she couldn't even put one leg down. I camped there for about 4 days and threw everything at her, every skill I had, every drug I had, and just couldn't get her any better. So I had to get trucked out, find myself another horse, and then I'd lost a bit of time. I had to meet the Seasons up north, so I thought, well, I'll just transport the horses up to Sydney or north of Sydney and leave from there, catch up on time, and when I come back around, I go all the way up to Sydney with the plan of going all the way around Australia. What happened was the truck driver rang me one day and said, oh, one of your horses, because it took a few days to get up to Sydney. He got up here and he said, one of your horses isn't looking too flash. So these are the new horses. That's Gumby the Legend. You'll hear a lot more about him in the talk. I bought him for $250 out of dog meat sales. He's about to go for a can of power. And that's me training him. As you can see, he's not a giant. But he's an absolute machine. So I was trucking these horses up. I'll just get you to stop there for a sec. I was trucking these horses up to Sydney, and truck driver rang me and said, oh, one of them's not looking too flash. And within 12 hours, all three of my horses had died of salmonella poisoning. So two that I'd travelled with in the Victorian Alps, and one that I'd got to replace the main one, all three had died, which was pretty devastating, to say the least. There's a couple of things. I'd spent 2 years preparing this ride, and all of a sudden I'd just lost everything. I'd sold my business, or given away all my clients. I'd sold my car. I had nowhere to live. I had no job. And all of a sudden, everything I'd been preparing for had gone. But the other and more devastating thing was two horses in particular that I'd ridden through the Alps, and they had just worked so hard for me, had lost a heap of weight. It was really hard yards. Victorian Alps was in the middle of the drought and it was really tough going for them. And they just put in the hard yards for me, and what did I do? I stuck them on a truck and killed them, basically. That was my state of mind at the time, anyway. So I sort of had to pick myself up off the ground and try and work out what I was going to do, and in the end decided to plough on. So I was home for about 8 weeks, had to find more horses. So I'd spent 2 years finding perfect three horses, and now I was back in the market looking for horses. So I just went into dog meat sales, just bought whatever I could find, which were these guys. You can start up again. So that's Gumby. Just keep rolling over things. That's Gumby, and as I said, best $250 I've ever spent. So he went with me basically for the rest of the trip. That's Willow. She was a really hard worker as well. That's Piglet, the horse that went three-legged lame. By that stage, she improved, and I decided to take her with me. And the other one there, that's Bart. I got him out of the dog meat sales as well. So I had three horses that were going to go for dog meat. So I gave him a very rushed course. Poor old Bart, I bought him one day, and about 4 days later he was on a float up to Queensland. So I took my sister, this is a terrible photo of my sister, she rode with me for 4 days because I had three very green horses and one Arab. And anyone who knows Arabs, they're not particularly easy to handle or always a pain. And left from Marlborough up in Queensland. That was in the middle of a drought. As you can see, a bit sunburnt on the nose. And you can see this pretty ordinary country, no feed for the horses, just travelled about 30 k's a day from waterhole to waterhole. And then after about a couple of weeks after I started in Queensland, this was in January, so the wet season should have well and truly started, and a couple of weeks after I started in Queensland, then the wet hit and managed to get pretty well bogged and get a bit of feed going, so the horses were a bit happier. The trouble was then it was extremely humid, so basically if anyone's tried to exercise in humidity, we just all crashed in a heap because we desperately needed salts, which I didn't have. I finally managed to get hold of some salts, and my horses just picked up hugely. Mm-hmm. Those two little kids there, both of them, that was the first time they'd seen rain, and they got 10 inches of it. So that was only a matter of about 3 or 4 days after the rain, the grass coming up through. So, where was I? When I was, that's a girl that I didn't know called Julia, who rang me up when I was struggling through the just the heat and the wet and the humidity and horses struggling and everything. And I got to Nebo and thought, I just can't keep doing this. And it rained at Nebo and I was camped there for a week and I was thinking, I can't leave, I failed. I just don't think I can do it. And anyway, a total stranger called Julia rang me up and said, oh, Peb, what are you doing? I was wondering if I could, trial along for a little bit. And I said, yeah, get here. So she jumped in her car and drove about 1,500 kilometres in 24 hours and abandoned her car at Nebo and came riding with me for 4 weeks, which is exactly what I needed. I needed a bit of a shot in the arm. So these are just, there's Barty Boy. These are just the horses going through the now very green area. The camp toilet was one of the better camps that I've had. It was great. We sheltered from the rain. That's all you need, shelter from the rain and drinking water. But I've camped in a lot of places and all you care about is water for the horses, feed for the horses and shelter for me if it's possible. So that's what they're like all loaded up. Take about 2 hours in the morning to load them all up from getting out of bed to packing up camp and loading them up. As you can see, it's quite a trick. Loading up a horse is very, very tricky. You've got to have within, even right down to 100 grams either side has to be weighted correctly. So I actually had a set of fish scales that I used to pick up each bag and every single item I weighed, so I had it perfectly balanced. If you had it badly balanced for the day, that was fine, the horse got through, but then they couldn't walk the next day because I was so sore and I had to be able to get my horses to walk every day. So those are the boots. I didn't wear shoes, horse shoes, if anyone knows anything about horses. I actually had them what's called barefoot because I wanted them to have good healthy feet, and it's much better to have healthy feet with bare feet rather than putting shoes on them, which restricts a lot of things. But those boots we'd put on in really stony areas or if they couldn't cope, and I learned to hate those boots. Lots of times had no idea where we were going and no idea how to open gates. A lot of cocky gates, we sat there for ages trying to work out how to open them up. So those trees all fallen over about a week before. The water had flown through there and knocked all those trees over, so that's the floods, that's the Bowen River. Those socks there are what we put on the horses to stop the boots rubbing and everything. So the floodwaters there were all the way up to the sort of the shadow or whatever mark on that pylon. Had a lot of washing to do as soon as we got into a town, stay in a town, and I'd have an awful lot of, I'm not sure why that got in there. But have an awful lot of washing and picking seeds out and repairs and trying to work out the next route. And I hated going into town because there was so much to do, ringing owners and farmers and seeing if we could go through their properties. And people were really friendly along the way. There was a particular path there that I think for about 10 days in a row, people were coming out and just handing me beer and sort of like, oh, it's 10 o'clock in the morning. Oh, okay. I particularly liked that guy. I was very nervous about going through it, but I was assured it was safe. And this fellow here had lost his house in a willy-willy 2 days beforehand, so that was his telephone. He'd managed to rig something up in there. But, the countryside was just beautiful and it was ever-changing. But one real advantage of travelling the way I was travelling was because I had to look for feed all the time for my horses and water, I had to really take good note of the country. I've done a lot of driving through the country, but it just, when you're on horseback, you just realise, you see the subtle changes every kilometre, every couple of kilometres. And you have to, after a while, I'd be looking and I'd just know water was going to be around soon because I just intuitively got to know where the water table sort of would be highest and that sort of thing. So that was a very common view, staring down at my hand while I was riding along. And then just some old places where people lived and fascinating old houses. Just people's generosity when we arrived up at their place was just fascinating. It sort of instilled a bit of faith in humanity, I suppose, on my ride. My ride was all about getting away from people, but I was surprised to learn that I didn't actually mind them after a while. We're travelling across, just stop there for a sec, we're just travelling across the top of, from Charters Towers across to the west. So, the friend, she was a friend after she came because she's a very, very hard worker. She sort of left me not far after this, so I was sort of back on my own. So this is in Pentland at the moment. The policewoman let us camp in her backyard. Okay, just a second. That was a swag my friend had, and I was very jealous of because it kept the mozzies out. Camps just had to be flexible. You had to just try and put your hoochie up any way you could to keep the rain or the dew. In Queensland, the dew's even worse than the rain. You get wetter. At the end of every day, we'd let the horses go, give them a rub down, and then they just loved to have their roll. That was their beer at the end of the day, I suppose. So I travelled. At that stage, I travelled with four horses and a dog. Then... And as you can see, I'm heading west now, from Chartist House across to Mount Isa. Country started to open up, and it started to dry up as well. This time it was around about April, and following stock routes. Some of the stock routes were pretty difficult to follow. There's a lot of drovers back in the old days, but these days hardly any drovers sort of operate, so some of the stock routes were really difficult to find and difficult to follow. That's a fairly typical view for months, actually, along the track. And there's my kids. There's lots of photos of my kids because that's all I had to take photos of, apart from scenery, really. My horses were basically living and breathing and working with them the whole time. It's amazing. I've worked with horses all my life, but you just get to know them and they get to respond to you really well, and they just work so hard for you. If something really scary happened, instead of racing off, galloping off, they all used to turn around and run straight to me. It's like, you'll fix it, you know, you'll protect me. That's a fairly typical toilet in Queensland. I had to put that in. When I got to Northern Territory, to Mount Isa, it was starting to dry out a bit, so I'd already arranged to... send my camels home and send my horses home except for one and take camels as pack camels. And so I picked up two camels. They were working pack camels of Andrew Harper, who works in the Simpson Desert. You might have heard of him. He's an amazingly generous guy. I rang him up and said what I was going to do and that sort of thing, and at the end of the conversation he basically lent me two camels for nearly 12 months of his working camels and all the gear and everything. Didn't charge me, delivered them to Mount Isa. So there's me petrified on my first day of camels because I'd only worked with them for a couple of weeks, 12 months before, at Andrew's place. But... And the camels weren't really going to have a bar of me either. The thing about working camels is that they work really, really hard if they respect you, and if they don't respect you, they'll just look at you as though you're an idiot and refuse to move. So my first couple of weeks were pretty tough, and then once I won them over, then they would just do anything for me. It's okay. And that's the fellow who delivered the camels for me, and he'd never touched a horse, so he was leading the camels around and petrified of touching poor little Gumby. Horses normally hate camels, but Gumby loved them, and when I let him go in the yard with them, he ran over to them and they ran away from him and he's sniffing them and everything, but he just adored them much better than he liked horses. So whenever we stopped at a camp or whatever and the camels would sit down, often they sort of sat down in formation staring into the sunset, and Gumby would hobble over and sit in between them and look at them like this and say, I'm one of you. They didn't really like him, but he didn't know that. So that's Pam, and the other one is Gypsy. I'm not sure how you could name a camel Pam, but in the end it actually really quite suited her. She was no mess, serious, hard worker, didn't want any funny business. Didn't want to be padded, just wanted to work really hard. And Gypsy was flighty, and that was really strange. In the middle of nowhere, that was sitting in the middle of a paddock, and I started to look over my shoulder after that. I was just wondering where exactly the Lord was. But I never saw him, and when I needed him, he never seemed to appear. So I'm sitting on Gumby at the moment, leading the camels. So that was a common view for months and months and months, just looking at that. It's very different travelling with camels, because with horses you tend to ride the horse and lead the pack horses. With camels, it tends to be all done a lot easier with walking. So I did a lot of walking leading the girls, as I called them. And as you can see, the camels and the horse absolutely hated poor old Furphy the dog. Furphy was a very strange dog. I decided if Furphy was actually a human, he'd probably be a postal worker that ended up being sacked and going back to his place of business and causing a bit of a problem. But he was a bit of a strange one. And we all struggled with Furphy, but anyway, he was always there, very loyal. I had people, some friends meet me along the way, which was really lucky because I hadn't seen a town for about 3 months and so I was running low on supplies, so had them give me some supplies. This stage of going across the Barkly Stock Route, which is sort of basically straight across the centre of Northern Territory, and it was about June and unseasonally we got 10 inches of rain in a week and it just rained and was freezing. And that was probably one of my first real challenges as far as I thought it was physically really difficult and it was freezing and I was thinking, am I going to get out of here? So you can see on those leather photos, the wet road was impassable by vehicles. And so I knew no one was going to come along, even though I stuck out a roadblock which had just been up to try and stop any traffic just in case someone had got through. But just stop there, thanks. But anyway, it was one of the first real challenges, and then afterwards I recognised it as a mental challenge, not so much a physical challenge. It was freezing cold. If I travelled, it was dangerous to the camels. If I didn't travel, we were going to be stuck there in the rain, and there wasn't any feed for the camels. Mentally, it was just a huge challenge. It just rained. It was cloudy. It was drizzling the whole time, and it was very oppressive. And then I think about then the eighth day, the sky cleared, the sun came out, and that was actually the day I arrived up at the Lanthony Lagoon station, which was the first station I've been at for about 3 weeks. And it just all changed around. All of a sudden, everything was clear. I could get through, and that was when I realised that physically I was never in any danger, but mentally I was really struggling. So I continued on across the Barkly Stock Route. As you can see, it's really open on the Barkly Stock Route. Really, really windy. There's a wind called the Barkly Breeze, which just is an easterly that just blows, I think from about March to November, and it's just relentless. It just blows and blows and blows. Whenever someone stopped and had a chat and they'd be leaning out the vehicle, I really had to refrain myself from grabbing them and just briefing them out of the car, jumping in and winding up the windows and getting out of that wind. My parents came and visited me for a couple of weeks and camped with me, and both me and Gumby were in love with the vehicle. It had absolutely everything, including a fridge and champagne, and Gumby used to go and sneak in and get fed to the eyeballs, steal all the oranges and the pumpkin and everything like that. But and then I was back on my own for this next stretch. I'll just stop there. That's a grid there. That's the border to a property called Newcastle Waters, which probably a lot of you have actually heard of. It's quite historical in Australia. I reached this border, and either side of the grid was a brand new five-strand barbed wire fence, very well put up, with not a single scrap of wire around and no gate either side. And I walked up and down the fence for kilometres looking for a gate and couldn't find a gate. So it was like the only choice I had was to cut the fence and then try and strain it back up again, or to cross, actually physically cross the grid. And I was looking at this fence and I was thinking, oh, I don't have any spare wire. They haven't left any wire around. I can't cut this brand new fence, and it's a boundary fence. It's worth different property. So I looked at the grid and looked at my kids and thought, right, we're going to have to do it. So I did something I never thought I'd do with a horse. I fronted him up to the grid and stood in front of him, picked up one foot, stuck it on a bar, walked to his back foot, picked up one foot, moved it forward, back foot, forward, front foot, on a bar. And I walked across the grid basically picking up each foot and putting it on a bar on the grid. And he didn't move a muscle. He just sat there the whole time watching me as I was circling him, going, oh, okay, you want my foot there, righto. And so I walked him across the grid. I'm very proud of him, but I'm also very embarrassed about admitting I did that, because I would have thought, if anybody had told me that I was going to do that with a horse, I'd just say, well, shoot me now, you just can't do that to a horse. But you can do it to a Gumby, definitely. Then fronted the camels up, And they've got such big, huge feet. They initially were typical camels. They're going, no, we don't cross breeds. But they had such big feet, they could cross the bars. And also being camels, they had such sort of faith in me that they sort of, okay, come on. All right. Yep. So then, and then they crossed and sort of trusted me. That was a really good day that day. I know it sounds like nothing, but it was huge for me. Just keep going. Lots of great sunsets. So at this stage, I've been travelling west and west, and you just seem to never take a turn. I got so bored of travelling west. And it's funny, you get these songs in your mind and things going around in your head. You don't see anyone for months and months or anything. And I just got this Pink Floyd song, Time, in my head, because it constantly felt like the sun was coming up behind me and landing in front of me, and I never seemed to reach where it was going. And Time has that line, you run, catch up with the sun. That's basically why I named the book that, because it just felt like what I was doing. I was trying to catch up with the sun and never sort of got there. Had lots of visitors into my camps. They'd just rock up and try and torture my horse and my camels and throw things at them and then insist on having a photo taken of themselves. Where I was in this stage in Western Northern Territory, there's a whole string of family properties all the way along. Terry Underwood, you might have heard of, she's written a book. And they were having a family reunion. And for hundreds and hundreds of kilometres, I was going through their properties, and all the families from the family reunion, which went for 3 weeks, kept stopping and going, oh, look, you look a bit dry, you have another beer. And I reckon I averaged about 3 beers before 12 o'clock every day while I'm sitting on the floor gumbing. So travelling to Halls Creek on this road was very, very long. And I turned off before I got to Halls Creek, but basically for 400 kilometres I was travelling, and every 10 kilometres was the little green sign saying 390 kilometres, 380 kilometres, 370 kilometres. It was a very, very long trip and some very open country, as you can see. Sorry, I've just got to catch up with my notes here. When I did cross over through the Northern Territory, was the first taste of the desert. I went just cut across the corner of the Tanami Desert, which I just absolutely loved. And then was really looking forward to the Canning Stock Route. Canning Stock Route's 1,800 kilometres long, that red part there. And it was built 100 years ago, or over 100 years ago, basically to travel cattle through 1,800 kilometres of desert to take the cattle from the northern market in Queensland and Northern Territory down into Perth area and to Kalgoorlie. And, of course, not a lot of drovers went there. It was pretty tough work. But basically the wells are on average 30 kilometres apart, but a lot of the wells nowadays are all trashed in. Some of them have been renovated by people, and a lot of tourists go along the Canning. I was going along the Canning in August, September, October, November, so it was getting pretty hot, and luckily there weren't so many tourists. But that bush there, the one that I just added, that bush there, I used to call Macca's drive-through, because it was a good bush that the camels always liked, and they'd always like to stop or grab some as they were walking along or whatever. So it was always a reliable bush for me to find for my camels. So the Canning Stock Route was a really tough road as far as that went. Average day was between 40 and 45 degrees. I could carry 300 litres of water. But there was a couple of working wells that... There was a couple of working wells that were like 200 kilometres apart, 300 kilometres apart, so it was really tough trying to manage my water. And at those stages, my camels didn't have anything to drink while the water I carried was just for me, the horse and Gumby. This well here is probably the best well in the whole trip, and I was really relying on getting water here and fresh, good water, beautiful water for drinking. As you can see, there's a snake up in the top right-hand corner. The water, I think that well's about 30 metres deep. As you can see the reflection of me taking the photo. Mm-hmm. You see that piece of wood in the water and see those white things in the water? Mm-hmm. They're actually maggots. And what had happened a few days before is there were two snakes there, and one of the snakes had a tourist had opened up the doors and the snake was right there and dropped the doors on the snake and killed it, and it dropped into the water and then rotted in the water. So that water, which had a rotting fly-struck snake in it, was my water to drink for the next 900 kilometres. And I called it skanky snake water because it was a type of smell. Dead reptile just has that type of smell. It's just infiltrative. And even I had bottles with little pop tops, and even as I sort of lifted it to my mouth, before I'd even popped the top, I could smell it before I could sort of taste it. And it was just awful. So I travelled... So I travelled for all that time with skanky snake water, and after a while I found myself... just getting a bit down in morale, and also getting a little bit confused. I'd work out calculations of when I was going to reach here or how fast I was going in my head, and I'd just get a little bit sort of, and I'd finally get to the end of my calculation and actually forgot what I was trying to calculate in the first place. And then I saw some people. I hadn't seen people for quite some time, and some people stopped and said, "Do you want anything?" And I said, "Oh, you got some fresh water?" And they said, "Yeah, here's some fresh water." They gave me 20 litres. They filled up my water that I was drinking for the day, and they also put 10 litres either side in some jerrys that I had. But tragically, I wasn't concentrating, and I said, "Here, put them in these two jerrys because they're empty." And they, as it turned out, as I'm walking along drinking the fresh water, just everything lifted. I started to concentrate so much better. I could work things out, and then I realised I'd stuck that 10 litres in some salty water that I had. I had about 5 litres of salty water in the bottom of these jerrys, and so basically that beautiful fresh Perth water was now salty and couldn't be drunk by me. The salty water could only be drunk by the horse and the camels that I was carrying. So, yeah, so water was not very reliable. When I got sort of about two-thirds of the way down the canning, my father and my uncle actually caught up with me and camped with me for a couple of weeks, which is a real saving mentally. My camels were starting to lose weight, and one of my camels was actually getting quite sick and quite skinny. So it was really good that they caught up with me, and they carried a lot of the gear that she had to carry, and they could drive back and forth and get water so I could actually give her water every day because she was really struggling. So, so there's actually a few photos now of people taking photos of me. Lots of wildlife on the Kenning Stock Route. And that's my father. That's not a setup. Dad was pretty hot that day. There's Lake Disappointment. If you've heard about Lake Disappointment, it's a huge lake that is just pure salt. And that's dry, of course, there. But it's just so big and so glary that you can hardly even look at it with sunglasses. So crossing, I had to cross what's called Savory Creek, which leads in there, and it had a little bit of water in it, but that there's not snow, that's actually salt. That it was just so salty, and for plants, even 4 or 5 metres away from the creek were just covered in salt like that. And that's basically the end of every day. I'd sit down. If I had the water, I'd put my feet in the water because they were got so swollen that my shoes were far too small. And I'd sit down and plan my route and try and work things out. Gumby often tried to help. The bees were great. As soon as I poured water into those buckets, Gumby couldn't drink the water straight away because the water in the jerrys would heat up so much I couldn't even put my hand in it. So I'd have to pour it into my canvas buckets, wait for it to cool down. And by that time, within a couple of minutes of water being out in the desert, bees just come from everywhere. And by that time, poor old Gum would try and walk over and try and get to his water, but there'd be so many bees hitting his face he'd have to walk away until sunset when the bees all disappeared, and then he could have a drink. That's a bung arrow, or a goanna. In WA they call them bung arrows. That's also down a well. He obviously lives on the frogs down there. The open wells just had a lot of birds. Birds would come in and get a drink, and a certain percentage of them would drown and contaminate the water, and a lot of the wells were just completely contaminated. My camels got very sick one day, and they were sick for a couple of days, and I thought I was going to lose them because of contaminated water. And then I finally reached a property called Granite Peak Station down the bottom of the Canning Stock Route. You can see how skinny Pam is there. So I thought, that's when I decided I couldn't continue on with Pam. So I tracked the camels and the horse back to New South Wales. I couldn't cross South Australia without the camels, because I couldn't cross with horses unless I had a backup crew, and I didn't have any friends to be a backup crew. So there's a great big gap there from the bottom of the Canning Stock route to Broken Hill there. So I started up at Broken Hill with got my horses back online and gave my camels back to Andrew Harper. I got a new dog because in the desert, Furphy got very, very sick with the heat, and he got very poor, and so my father took him home when he left. And by the time I got home, my dog had attached himself completely to Dad, and since I didn't really like my dog anyway, I got myself a new one, much better dog that has no control over her ears. But so she was on the road from 4 months old, and probably 4 or 5 months old, she was doing about 150 k's a day. I'd do 30 k's a day, and she'd just be back and forth, back and forth. I had a couple of friends travel with me just for a week at a time, so that's when I get an opportunity to actually get photos of my horses working and everything. But travelling from Broken Hill down to the Murray River in South New South Wales, as you can see, it was the worst droughty country I'd actually been through. And I had to get, for that whole trip, I had to get hay dropped off everywhere. I was lucky enough to find someone to just drop hay off all the way along. But I went through properties that actually had not had stock on it for 3-4 years, so they'd had no income on that property for 3 or 4 years because there wasn't a single blade of grass willing to pop its head up. As you can see, I mean, that's his paddock. So, but the generosity of people just amazed me. The further out back you go, and also the harder the times, the people got more generous. A couple of people in this area that hadn't had stock for 3 or 4 years actually came out, met me at night, fed me their barbecue, fed me some beer, fed my horses, gave my dog a bone, and gave me $50 to donate to Youth Off the Streets. Just really, really generous people. Whereas the people in the really populated areas, you know, they'll go, oh, here you are, here's a $2 coin. You go, great, my horses have got to carry a $2 coin for 300 kilometres before I can find a bank, thanks. But, as you can see, no feed whatsoever. So I travelled down and from Broken Hill, basically down to my parents' place in South New South Wales. And when I got down there, it was May, and so I thought, well, I've got to travel up to Queensland, up to Marlborough, where I'd sort of left with the new horses. So I decided to take the horses up to Queensland and travel south so that I've worked out better weather-wise. So the cheapest way to actually travel my four horses up to Queensland was to buy that old truck there, which I called Tumbleweed, and cost me $2,500 to buy the truck. And I thought, well, if it busts, you know, if it busts, I'll just get out and saddle the horses up and keep on going. But it got me up to Queensland, and then we travelled back down. So there's Piglet, Gumby and Barty. Sorry, at this stage I had three horses. And Gumby hates dogs, so Gumby was lining Gilly up. Gilly was totally oblivious. As you can see, Gumby there has a winter coat on because he's been down south and it's May. So they struggled a little bit when I took them up north, and it was sort of pretty hot and they were working hard and they had their long coats. So from then on, basically it was a bit of a letdown. My ride was through getting more and more populated country and getting more and more difficult to travel just much less inspiring country, really. So I travelled south, sort of down the Bicentennial National Trail, which travels down sort of parallel to the coast of Australia. That's me spraying my horses for ticks, because I crossed the tick line a few times. I had to keep spraying my horses for ticks so I didn't transport ticks back and forth over the line. So basically just entering New South Wales and travelling back down to my parents' property down in South New South Wales. Piglet went lame again, so I left her there at Crow's Nest in just South Queensland and picked up another horse. That's the back end of that horse, Argie, and then travelled down. So the country, it was great country, but sometimes I'd be going through places that had 5-acre blocks and busy roads, and at one stage I had two chihuahuas chasing me down the road, barking at me, and I just thought, I've got to get out of here, I've got to head west. So I started to, once I hit the South Wales, I headed sort of west to get inland, get off the rough country and get into the more open country, which I like. I was born in open country, so when it's really hilly and rough and mountainous, I start to get a little bit claustrophobic. But this is around Tenerfield. All my camps, I had to basically do a new camp every day, work out some new architectural structure to stop the dew and the rain and the weather and everything getting onto all my gear. More friendly people helping me. And I'm trying to break into my camp again. One of the things I had to do was every night I had to put the electric fence up to keep my horses in. I had them hobbled, but they can move a long way with hobbles, so I had to put the electric fence up, which I absolutely hated. Occasionally I'd take the opportunity, if there was a bit of a small yard or something, to not put the fence up, and I used to love that, except I learnt very quickly I couldn't camp in the same paddock as my horses, because they used to work as a team and come and raid my camp, and while one was distracting me, the other one would raid my kitchen box and run off with 2-minute noodles and all sorts of things in their mouths. So Gumby got a real taste for 2-minute noodles, including the flavour sachet. He'd eat the noodles and then he'd break into the sachet and eat the sachet. Okay. So just then coming down south, Julia, the girl that saved my life basically in Nebo and helped me keep on going, she rang up and said she'd like to come the last few weeks with me. So that's Julia. She lobbed on with me, even though at one stage we only had one riding horse, so we had to share riding Gumby. But we used to camp everywhere, show grounds, but mostly out in paddocks in the middle of nowhere. Okay, so it took a total of 2 years and 3 months. Oh, grass seeds were the bane of my life, just constantly picking out grass seeds and all sorts of things. Every night you'd have to sit down, pick it all out of your saddle blankets, out of your girths, out of your shoes, everything. So yeah, it took me 2 years and 3 months, total of nearly 9,000 kilometres, and I still have to do the Nullarbor. I still have Gumby. Gumby and I are going to go and do the Nullarbor. We've just got to find some camels, and we'll be on our way. Actually, I've got to pay off my ride first, but anyway. Sometimes the wind got pretty bad. That was a tent we only occasionally put up, and it really didn't need to go up, but we decided we had to put it up because everything was going to blow away otherwise. That's Julia deciding that sometimes you really should wash your sock. And that was actually our last night of camping. We got 40 degrees, a dust storm, and about 1/2 inch of rain, and coming into the final gates, and there's Bardi. So
we'll come to questions and discussion. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Hardy Douglas's Catch Up With The Sun, which is the story of riding through Australia with her horse, two grumpy camels, one feral Kelpie. I thought you'd been unkind to Furphy, actually. Yeah.
You haven't met him.
We've only got 3 dogs. I've only got room for another one, so if you want... Furphy looks all right. So we've come to questions and discussion. So Janet Grundy's got some copies of that. So we've got till 7 o'clock, so we have 15 minutes. Just... You're a vet and a pilot, and here we do a bit of amateur psychology. I mean, how bad was school? I mean, it drove you into the bush, and then sort of doing a Burke and Wills with only camels and dogs and horses to talk to. I mean, how bad was it that you had to do this to find yourself? You had to lose yourself to find yourself.
I suppose it depends on who you are, really.
Where did you board?
I boarded in Melbourne at Furbank Girls' School. But I went from a school of 9 kids in a district called Cornwall, and I was a very country girl. and then just was sent to boarding school. And I just, the city, all of the girls at school were concerned about what they were wearing and how they were looking and what boyfriends they had, and I just didn't think they were very realistic in life. And so all I wanted to do was just get on the horse and ride away, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I've driven past Furbank and never sort of appealed to me. Right, so there's a question here. Yeah.
Yes, you said you do some sort of therapy with dogs. With my dog, which we've had about 2 years, and we've known him for years and loved him.
Yeah, but I think we better be quick with this because he wasn't on the trip.
United States, and now he lives with me, and he's got some sort of sexual jealousy of my son. I mean, if I'm in the
I think we better. Yeah. I think translating that and making it relevant. Did Furphy suffer any sexual jealousy on this long trip to Mount Disappointment? I mean, that's.
No.
Charge for consultations.
Right, down the top, yes.
The stock routes that you travel are well known for stinging nettle. Did you come across stinging nettle at all?
Stinging nettle, yeah.
Yeah, yes, yeah. That was the least of my worries.
Just come back and try to this microphone.
Sorry, yeah, that was the least of my worries, really. Yeah.
So what were the worst of your worries? What was the greatest problem that you had?
My continual worry was keeping my animals healthy and fit and in top condition. It wasn't so much a worry about me. I didn't, you know, like. If they weren't in top condition, then I wasn't going to survive. So I had to keep them. Have water for them every day. I had to have good food for them, and that was a continual worry. When I had the horse and camels, that was interesting because they eat totally different things. So instead of looking for a camp that's got good horse feed, now I'm looking for a camp that's got good camel food and good horse feed. And in the end, poor old Gumby just had to eat Spinifex, which is not particularly appetising, especially when it's not flowering. And so my constant worry was looking after my animals. And then the third thing, water's the first, food's the second, and then keeping them pain-free, keeping them healthy, stopping the saddles from rubbing, keeping their feet in good order, and stop them from going sour. Yeah.
There's a question here that is,
how did the fundraising go? Are you happy with it, disappointed?
Question about the fundraising.
Well, let's put it this way. I spent more money than I made for Youth Off the Streets. Like, all money that was donated went straight to Youth Off the Streets, and I spent more money doing my ride. It was a little bit disappointing, but probably couldn't be helped because it was just me, and I was just busy surviving and organising and doing everything that I didn't. I used to send out emails to, say, agricultural companies. But, of course, I wouldn't get back into email range for another 3 months, so I couldn't follow it up and harass people. And basically the only way to get people to sponsor you in sort of bigger amounts was literally to harass and harass and harass them. I got a $5,000 donation from CPC, but that was because the CEO of the company lived on a Newcastle Waters where I stopped, and had a great chat with him, and we had chatted about all sorts of things, and he used to be a drover, so we had all sorts of chats, and then I hit him hard.
You obviously prepared for the journey, but how much was preparation and how much was using your own skill and wits on the road? I mean, it seemed like in some places you had no idea exactly where the track would take you. And what kind of communication did you have with the outside world? I mean, did you have mobile contact? I was listening to someone this morning who sailed around Australia, not as a marathon, but just for pleasure. But in a sailboat, you have radio contact and things like that. I mean,
yep.
To what extent could you keep in touch if something could go wrong?
I had the first part of the question. I can't remember what it was.
Firstly, how much did you prepare, and how much did you have to do?
Because I hadn't actually done something like this, I had 2 years preparing, going, I wonder if this is right, and then spent probably the first 3-4 months of my travelling just posting stuff home, don't need that, and maybe getting mum to buy something and post it to me. So, everything sort of had to change a little bit. And as far as communications go, I had a flexible solar panel that was over the top of one of the packs and a little closed-cell motorbike battery. that would charge it up, and that used to charge up. First thing I charged up was my satellite phone. I had a satellite phone. Well, Telstra actually lent me a satellite phone. It didn't work for half the trip, and then I managed to get a new satellite phone out of them. When it was really wet in Northern Territory, my satellite phone was busted and it wasn't working at all. So actually one thing I said, I was actually reported as a missing person then, even though I wasn't missing. I was still on the road where I was supposed to be, but no one could see me there because I couldn't drive on the track. But some well-meaning person reported that I'd come across 2 weeks before, reported me as a missing person. So the police were ringing up all the stations around looking for me. So I had this satellite phone, and I used to text my parents. When I was in the really bad remote country, I used to text my parents my latitude and longitude every 3-4 days. Yeah.
When you started off with horses,
yep.
And then later on found that it would be better if you found some camels, and then towards the end of your journey, you ended up with horses only. When did you actually start with the camels, and when did you finish? I mean, which part of Australia did you sort of get with camels and then handed back?
I started with the camels near Mount Isa, mm-hmm. and headed west from there, and then sort of went right across west near Horse Creek, down the Canning, and I was going to continue Nullarbor with camels, but that's when I had to stop because they went well. And I started up with horses at Broken Hill or near Broken Hill because that was basically as far west as I could go, because South Australia
wasn't stock routes. Were you with your camels?
May to December, mm-hmm. April to December, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where are they now?
Pam, the one that was sick, has retired, and Gypsy, I think she's got tourists on her back. Somewhere around Alice Springs. She's not doing the hard packing across
what
the
What do camels do when they're retired?
I think they love work, so they get very grumpy, a working camel. Yeah. When we stopped for a break, they hated stopping for a couple of days off. They'd get very sour.
Jared was a camel in an earlier life.
So a camel retirement home is a place to avoid, is what you're saying?
Oh, definitely, yes.
There's
yeah.
a question here, and then we go down there. Yeah.
Hi, I just want to know, did you write any of the book whilst you were on the route, or did you write it all afterwards?
Yes and no. No, I didn't, and I never had any intention of writing a book. Because, to be perfectly honest, it's not a book that I would read. I was saying that before. I only read murder mysteries. But what I did was I wrote a journal every day, and I just write the mundane stuff as well as the unusual stuff. And at the end of every day, I forced myself to write a good point and a bad point of every day. A friend of mine about 12 months after I was back was harassing me to write a book, and I'm going, oh, man, I want to be interested. No, I want to be interested, and I didn't want to write it. I'm hopeless at English, and anyway. So she harassed me to write it, and I thought, I know, I'll write it. I'll take the opportunity of being able to read through all my journals. So a lot of it is direct quotes from my journals or whatever. And then I said, and I'll show it to her, and she'll go. But anyway, it ended up being sent to a publisher.
English no good at Fintona?
Sorry?
English no good at Fintona?
A Furbank.
Furbank? English no good at Furbank?
No, just me no good.
Sorry, it's Furbank. Furbank, yeah. Yeah.
Do you intend to complete the journey as part of being sponsored, or have you come to the end of what you're aiming?
So the question is just for back. Are you still looking for sponsors to complete this journey?
Oh, sponsorship's great, but I just don't have that sort of skill for some reason. I just could never cut a break with trying to get sponsorship or anything. My intention is to complete the journey before I'm too old and before Gumby's too old, and it'll probably take about 4 months, so it won't be huge. And if I found sponsorship, that'd be great, but I'm not sort of actively looking for it or anything like that. I'm more trying to save up.
Yes.
Obviously, you had topographic maps and GPS and stuff like that. So, did you ever find yourself lost, or it wasn't correlated very well?
I mean, a couple of times I was a bit, what's happening here? And I never used the GPS. I only used the GPS to tell me what distance I'd travelled. And in my diary, I wrote down the Latin long, just so I could say that. I always used topographic maps. But never got lost as such. A couple of times, you know, the map would be wrong or the something would have changed and I'd be going, what's going on here? But I knew where I was. Yeah, pretty much.
We go to quick, yeah.
What was your sleep pattern like? Did you sleep well or did you...
I slept like a log most of the times, yeah. The times I didn't sleep, I think it's a bit like a mother with a baby. The times I didn't sleep when I knew there was wild camels around or stallions around that would come in and disturb my children. And, you know, the speed that I could leap up and untangle myself from the swag and go running through the night with a stock whip screaming, chasing off wild animals had got down pretty short. Yeah.
Is that in your book?
I'm not sure, actually. I think I might have mentioned it a few times.
So just a final question. Obviously, I couldn't do all this, but obviously your training in the Australian Defence Force must have been of assistance, mustn't it? Your time there.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit of survival skills. Yeah, because I sort of did the combat survival course. And some navigation training through, Air Force and commercial pilot, yeah.
Did you ever get close to dying?
I'm not sure. I didn't. I got cellulitis went down one side of my face, and that wasn't very pleasant for a few days. I was out in the Canning Stock Route then. And there was another time where my camels got really quite sick from the birds contaminating the water, and I was sort of stuck in the middle of nowhere with no water and couldn't move my camels, and I had to try and decide what I was going to do, and I sort of got to the point where get up in the morning and either shoot one or two camels, leave them behind and hope they can find some wild camels, or leave the bags and take them with me, or, you know, just depending on how sick they were. But I'd sort of worked out, I can't remember how many kilometres it was, that I thought, yep, I've got enough water for me, Gumby and the dog to walk that far through the night and make it hopefully to the next water if that well was actually reliable. Yeah.
Great story. Many thanks. Take a seat. Yeah, well, it's a great story. It's quite heroic and quite fascinating. I still think you're a bit tough on Furphy, but every dog has got its day, and at least he gets in the first half of the book, I suppose. Well, I didn't quite know what to expect at a glance at your book, but it's a fascinating story. It tells us a lot about Furbank, I guess, that does. But there you go. So, Catch Up with the Sun, Janet Grundy's got some copies. It's a fascinating tale, and with a little bit left to do across the Nullarbor, with Gumpy, if she's still up to it. So, many thanks for coming here and telling us about in your journey, about a slightly different journey to the journeys most of us go through. So, and to come back and tell us about, as Anne was saying, about the trip across the Nullarbor and being asked to Furphy. Okay. Well done. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.